Chapter 11 Accident. Miss Marple's tea was brought at 7:30 the following morning, so as to allow her plenty of time to get up and pack her few belongings. She was just closing her small suitcase when there was a rather hurried tap on the door, and Clotilde came in, looking upset.
"Oh, dear, Miss Marple, there is a young man downstairs who's called to see you. Emlyn Price. He is on the tour with you, and they sent him here."
"Of course. I remember him. Yes, quite young."
"Oh, yes, very modern-looking and a lot of hair and all that. But he's really come to, well, to break some bad news to you. There's been, I'm sorry to say, an accident."
"An accident?" Miss Marple stared. "You mean to the coach? There has been an accident on the road? Someone has been hurt?"
No, it was not the coach. There was no trouble there. It was in the course of the expedition yesterday afternoon. There was a great deal of wind, you may remember, though I don't think that had anything to do with it. People strayed about a bit, I think. There is a regular path, but you can also climb up and go across the downs. Both ways lead to the memorial tower on the top of Bonaventure, where they were all making for. People got separated a bit, and I suppose, really, there was no one actually guiding them or looking after them, which perhaps there ought to have been. People aren't very sure-footed always, and the slope overhanging the gorge is very steep. There was a bad fall of stones or rocks which came crashing down the hillside and knocked someone out on the path below.
"Oh, dear," said Miss Marple. "I am sorry. I'm most terribly sorry. Who was it who was hurt?"
Miss Temple or Tenderden, I understand."
"Elizabeth Temple," said Miss Marple. "Oh, dear, I am sorry. I talked to her a good deal. I sat in the next seat to her on the coach. She is, I believe, a retired schoolmistress, a very well-known one."
"Of course," said Clotilde. "I know her quite well. She was headmistress of Fallowfield, quite a famous school. I'd no idea she was on this tour." "She retired as headmistress, I think, a year or two ago, and there is a new, rather young headmistress there now with rather advanced progressive ideas. But Miss Temple is not very old, really. She's about 60, I should think, and very active, fond of climbing and walking and all the rest of it. This really seems most unfortunate. I hope she's not badly hurt. I haven't heard any details yet."
"This is quite ready now," said Miss Marple, snapping down the lid of her suitcase. "I will come down at once and see Mr. Price."
Clotilde seized the suitcase. "Let me. I can carry this perfectly. Come down with me and be careful of the stairs."
Miss Marple came down. Emlyn Price was waiting for her. His hair was looking even wilder than usual, and he was wearing a splendid array of fancy boots and a leather jerkin and brilliant emerald green trousers. "Such an unfortunate business," he said, seizing Miss Marple's hand. "I thought I'd come along myself and, well, break it to you about the accident. I expect Miss Bradbury Scott has told you. It's Miss Temple, you know, the school dame. I don't know quite what she was doing or what happened, but some stones, or rather boulders, rolled down from above. It's rather a precipitous slope, and it knocked her out, and they had to take her off to hospital with concussion last night. I gather she's rather bad. Anyway, the tour for today is cancelled, and we are stopping on here tonight." "Oh, dear," said Miss Marple. "I am sorry. I'm very sorry."
"I think they've decided not to go on today because they really have to wait and see what the medical report is. So we are proposing to spend one more night here at the Golden Boar and to rearrange the tour a little so that perhaps we shall miss out altogether going to Grangemering, which we were going to do tomorrow, and which is not very interesting, really, or so they say. Mrs. Sanborn has gone off early to the hospital to see how things are this morning. She's going to join us at the Golden Boar for coffee at 11 o'clock. I thought perhaps you'd like to come along and hear the latest news."
"I'll certainly come along with you," said Miss Marple. "Of course, at once." She turned to say goodbye to Clotilde and Mrs. Glynn, who had joined her. "I must thank you so much," she said. "You've been so kind, and it has been so delightful to have these two nights here. I feel so rested and everything. Most unfortunate this has occurred."
"If you would like to spend another night," said Mrs. Glynn, "I am sure..."
She looked at Clotilde. It occurred to Miss Marple, who had as sharp a sideways glance as anyone could desire, that Clotilde had a slightly disapproving look. She almost shook her head, though it was such a small movement that it was hardly noticeable. But she was, Miss Marple thought, hushing down the suggestion that Mrs. Glynn was making. "Although, of course, I expect it will be nicer for you to be with the others and to—" "Oh, yes, I think it would be better," said Miss Marple. "I shall know then what the plans are and what to do about things, and perhaps I could be of help in some way. One never knows. So thank you again very much. It will not be difficult, I expect, to get a room at the Golden Boar." She looked at Emlyn, who said reassuringly, "That'll be all right. Several rooms have been vacated today. They won't be full at all. Mrs. Sanborn, I think, has booked for all the party to stay there tonight, and tomorrow we shall see. Well, we shall see how all this goes on." Goodbyes were said again, and thanks. Emlyn Price took Miss Marple's belongings and started out at a good striding pace. "It's really only just round the corner, and then the first street to the left," he said. "Yes, I passed it yesterday, I think. Poor Miss Temple, I do hope she's not badly hurt." "I think she is, rather," said Emlyn Price. "Of course, you know what doctors are and hospital people. They say the same thing always, as well as can be expected. There's no local hospital. They had to take her to Carristown, which is about 8 miles away. Anyway, Mrs. Sanborn will be back with the news by the time we fixed you up at the hotel." They got there to find the tour assembled in the coffee room, and coffee and morning buns and pastries were being served. Mr. and Mrs. Butler were talking at the moment.
"Oh, it's just too tragic, this happening," said Mrs. Butler. "Just too upsetting, isn't it? Just when we were all so happy and enjoying everything so much. Poor Miss Temple. And I always thought she was very sure-footed. But there, you know, you never can tell, can you, Henry?"
"No, indeed," said Henry. "No, indeed. I am wondering, really, yes, our time is very short, you know, whether we hadn't better, well, give up this tour at this point here, not continue with it. It seems to me that there's bound to be a bit of difficulty resuming things until we know definitely. If this was, well, I mean, if this should be so serious that it could prove fatal, there might, well, I mean, there might have to be an inquest or something of that kind."
"Oh, Henry, don't say dreadful things like that."
"I'm sure," said Miss Cook, "that you are being a little too pessimistic, Mr. Butler. I'm sure that things couldn't be as serious as that."
In his foreign voice, Mr. Caspar said, "But yes, they are serious. I hear yesterday, when Mrs. Sanborn talk on telephone to doctor, is very, very serious. They say she has concussion bad, very bad. A special doctor, he is coming to look at her and see if he can operate or if impossible. Yes, it is all very bad."
"Oh, dear," said Miss Lumley. "If there's any doubt, perhaps we ought to go home, Mildred. I must look up the trains, I think."
She turned to Mrs. Butler.
"You see, I have made arrangements about my cats with the neighbours, and if I was delayed a day or two, it might make great difficulties for everyone."
"Well, it's no good our working ourselves up too much," said Mrs. Risley Porter, in her deep, authoritative voice. "Joanna, put this bun in the waste-paper basket, will you? It is really quite uneatable, most unpleasant jam. But I don't want to leave it on my plate. It might make for bad feeling."
Joanna got rid of the bun. She said, "Do you think it would be all right if Emlyn and I went out for a walk? I mean, just saw something of the town. It's not much good our sitting about here making gloomy remarks, is it? We can't do anything."
"I think you'd be very wise to go out," said Miss Cook.
"Yes, you go along,"
said Miss Barrow, before Mrs. Risley Porter could speak. Miss Cook and Miss Barrow looked at each other and sighed, shaking their heads.
"The grass was very slippery," said Miss Barrow. "I slid once or twice myself, you know, on that very short turf."
"And the stones, too," said Miss Cook. Quite a shower of small stones fell down just as I was turning a corner on the path. Yes, one struck me on the shoulder quite sharply.
Tea, coffee, biscuits and cakes dispatched, everyone seemed somewhat dissociated and ill at ease. When a catastrophe has occurred, it is very difficult to know what is the proper way to meet it. Everyone had given their view, had expressed surprise and distress. They were now awaiting news, and at the same time had a slight hankering after some form of sightseeing, some interest to carry them through the morning. Lunch would not be served until 1 o'clock, and they really felt that to sit around and repeat their same remarks would be rather a gloomy business. Miss Cook and Miss Barrow rose as one woman and explained that it was necessary for them to do a little shopping. One or two things they needed, and they also wished to go to the post office and buy stamps.
I want to send off one or two postcards, and I want to inquire about postal dues on a letter to China, said Miss Barrow.
And I want to match some walls, said Miss Cook. And also, it seemed to me, there was rather an interesting building on the other side of the market square.
I think it would do us all good to get out, said Miss Barrow.
Colonel and Mrs. Walker also rose and suggested to Mr. and Mrs. Butler that they too might go out and see what there was to see. Mrs. Butler expressed hopes of an antique shop.
Only I don't really mean a real antique shop, more what you would call a junk shop. Sometimes you can pick up some really interesting things there.
They all trooped out. Emlyn Price had already sidled to the door and disappeared in pursuit of Joanna without troubling to use conversation to explain his departure. Mrs. Risley Porter, having made a belated attempt to call her niece back, said she thought that at least the lounge would be rather more pleasant to sit in. Miss Lumley agreed. Mr. Caspar escorted the ladies with the air of a foreign equerry. Professor Wanstead and Miss Marple remained.
I think myself, said Professor Wanstead, addressing Miss Marple, that it would be pleasant to sit outside the hotel. There is a small terrace giving on the street, if I might persuade you.
Miss Marple thanked him and rose to her feet. She had hardly exchanged a word so far with Professor Wanstead. He had several learned-looking books with him, one of which he was usually perusing. Even in the coach he continued to try and read.
"But perhaps you, too, want to shop," he said. "For myself, I would prefer to wait somewhere peacefully for the return of Mrs. Sanborn. It is important, I think, that we should know exactly what we're in for."
"I quite agree with you as to that," said Miss Marple. "I did a certain amount of walking round the town yesterday, and I don't feel any necessity to do so again today. I'd rather wait here, in case there is anything I can do to help. Not that I suppose there is, but one never knows."
They moved together through the hotel door and round the corner to where there was a little square of garden with a raised stone walk close to the wall of the hotel and on which there were various forms of basket chairs. There was no one there at the moment, so they sat down. Miss Marple looked thoughtfully at her vis-à-vis, at his corrugated and wrinkled face, his bushy brows, his luxuriant head of grey hair. He walked with a slight stoop. He had an interesting face, Miss Marple decided. His voice was dry and caustic, a professional man of some kind, she thought.
"I'm not wrong, am I?" said Professor Wanstead. "You are Miss Jane Marple?"
"Yes, I am Jane Marple."
She was slightly surprised, though for no particular reason. They had not been long enough together for people to be identified by the other travellers. The last two nights she had not been with the rest of the party. It was quite natural.
"I thought so," said Professor Wanstead, "from a description I have heard of you."
"A description of me?" Miss Marple was again slightly surprised.
"Yes, I had a description of you."
He paused for a moment. His voice was not exactly lowered, but it lost volume, although she could still hear it quite easily.
"From Mr. Raphael."
"Oh," said Miss Marple, startled. "From Mr. Raphael."
"You are surprised?"
"Well, yes, I am rather."
"I don't know that you should be.
I didn't expect, began Miss Marple, and then stopped.
Professor Wanstead did not speak. He was merely sitting, looking at her intently.
In a minute or two, thought Miss Marple to herself, he will say to me, what symptoms exactly, dear lady? Any discomfort in swallowing? Any lack of sleep? Digestion in good order?
She was almost sure now that he was a doctor.
When did he describe me to you? That must have been...
You were going to say some time ago, some weeks ago, before his death. That is so. He told me that you would be on this tour.
And he knew that you would be on it too, that you were going on it?
You can put it that way, said Professor Wanstead. He said, he continued, that you would be travelling on this tour, that he had in fact arranged for you to be travelling on this tour.
It was very kind of him, said Miss Marple, very kind indeed. I was most surprised when I found he'd booked me. Such a treat, which I could not have afforded for myself.
Yes, said Professor Wanstead, very well put.
He nodded his head as one who applauds a good performance by a pupil.
It is sad that it has been interrupted in this fashion, said Miss Marple. Very sad indeed, when I am sure we were all enjoying ourselves so much.
Yes, said Professor Wanstead. Yes, very sad. And unexpected, do you think, or not unexpected?
Now, what do you mean by that, Professor Wanstead?
His lips curled in a slight smile as he met her challenging look.
Mr. Raphael, he said, spoke to me about you at some length, Miss Marple. He suggested that I should be on this tour with you. I should, in due course, almost certainly make your acquaintance, since members in a tour inevitably do make each other's acquaintance, though it usually takes a day or two for them to split up, as it were, into possible groupings led by similar tastes or interests. And he further suggested to me that I should, shall we say, keep an eye on you.
Keep an eye on me, said Miss Marple, showing some slight displeasure. And for what reason?
I think reasons of protection. He wanted to be quite sure that nothing should happen to you.
Happen to me? What should happen to me, I should like to know.
Possibly what happened to Miss Elizabeth Temple, said Professor Wanstead.
Joanna Crawford came round the corner of the hotel. She was carrying a shopping basket. She passed them, nodding a little. She looked towards them with slight curiosity and went on down the street. Professor Wanstead did not speak until she had gone out of sight.
A nice girl, he said. At least I think so. Content at present to be a beast of burden to an autocratic aunt, but I have no doubt we'll reach the age of rebellion fairly soon.
What did you mean by what you said just now? Said Miss Marple, uninterested for the moment in Joanna's possible rebellion.
That is a question which perhaps, owing to what has happened, we shall have to discuss.
You mean because of the accident?
Yes, if it was an accident.
Do you think it wasn't an accident?
Well, I think it's just possible, that's all.
I don't, of course, know anything about it, said Miss Marple, hesitating.
No, you were absent from the scene. You were, shall I put it this way, were you just possibly on duty elsewhere?
Miss Marple was silent for a moment. She looked at Professor Wanstead once or twice, and then she said,
I don't think I know exactly what you mean.
You are being careful. You are quite right to be careful.
I have made it a habit, said Miss Marple.
To be careful?
I should not put it exactly like that, but I have made a point of being always ready to disbelieve as well as believe anything that is told to me.
Yes, and you are quite right, too. You don't know anything about me. You know my name from the passenger list of a very agreeable tour, visiting castles and historic houses and splendid gardens. Possibly the gardens are what will interest you most.
Possibly.
There are other people here, too, who are interested in gardens.
Or profess to be interested in gardens.
Ah, said Professor Wanstead, you have noticed that.
He went on,
well, it was my part, or at any rate to begin with, to observe you, to watch what you were doing, to be near at hand in case there was any possibility of, well, we might call it roughly, dirty work of any kind. But things are slightly altered now. You must make up your mind if I am your enemy or your ally.
Perhaps you are right, said Miss Marple. You put it very clearly, but you have not given me any information about yourself yet on which to judge. You were a friend, I presume, of the late Mr. Raphael?
No, said Professor Wanstead. I was not a friend of Mr. Raphael. I had met him once or twice. Once on a committee of a hospital, once at some other public event. I knew about him. He, I gather, also knew about me. If I say to you, Miss Marple, that I am a man of some eminence in my own profession, you may think me a man of bounding conceit.
I don't think so, said Miss Marple. I should say, if you say that about yourself, that you are probably speaking the truth. You are perhaps a medical man.
Ah, you are perceptive, Miss Marple. Yes, you are quite perceptive. I have a medical degree, but I have a speciality too. I am a pathologist and psychologist. I don't carry credentials about with me. You will probably have to take my word up to a certain point, though I can show you letters addressed to me and possibly official documents that might convince you. I undertake mainly specialist work in connection with medical jurisprudence. To put it in perfectly plain everyday language, I am interested in the different types of criminal brain. That has been a study of mine for many years. I have written books on the subject, some of them violently disputed, some of them which have attracted adherence to my ideas. I do not do very arduous work nowadays. I spend my time mainly writing up my subject, stressing certain points that have appealed to me. From time to time, I come across things that strike me as interesting, things that I want to study more closely. This, I'm afraid, must seem rather tedious to you.
Not at all, said Miss Marple. I am hoping, perhaps, from what you are saying now, that you will be able to explain to me certain things which Mr. Raphael did not see fit to explain to me. He asked me to embark upon a certain project, but he gave me no useful information on which to work. He left me to accept it and proceed, as it were, completely in the dark. It seemed to me extremely foolish of him to treat the matter in that way.
But you accepted it.
I accepted it. I will be quite honest with you. I had a financial incentive.
Did that weigh with you?
Miss Marple was silent for a moment, and then she said slowly, "You may not believe it, but my answer to that is, not really."
I am not surprised. But your interest was aroused. That is what you are trying to tell me.
Yes, my interest was aroused. I had known Mr. Raphael, not well, casually, but for a certain period of time, some weeks, in fact, in the West Indies. I see you know about it, more or less.
I know that that was where Mr. Raphael met you, and where, shall I say, you two collaborated.
Miss Marple looked at him rather doubtfully. Oh, she said. He said that, did he? She shook her head.
Yes, he did, said Professor Wanstead. He said you had a remarkable flair for criminal matters.
Miss Marple raised her eyebrows as she looked at him. And I suppose that seems to you most unlikely, she said. It surprises you.
I seldom allow myself to be surprised at what happens, said Professor Wanstead. Mr. Raphael was a very shrewd and astute man, a good judge of people. He thought that you, too, were a good judge of people.
I would not set myself up as a good judge of people, said Miss Marple. I would only say that certain people remind me of certain other people that I have known, and that therefore I can presuppose a certain likeness between the way they would act. If you think I know all about what I'm supposed to be doing here, you are wrong.
By accident more than design, said Professor Wanstead, we seem to have settled here in a particularly suitable spot for discussion of certain matters. We do not appear to be overlooked. We cannot easily be overheard. We are not near a window or a door, and there is no balcony or window overhead. In fact, we can talk.
I should appreciate that, said Miss Marple. I am stressing the fact that I am myself completely in the dark as to what I am doing or supposed to be doing. I don't know why Mr. Raphael wanted it that way.
I think I can guess that. He wanted you to approach a certain set of facts, of happenings, unbiased by what anyone would tell you first.
So you are not going to tell me anything either? Miss Marple sounded irritated. Really, she said, there are limits.
Yes, said Professor Wanstead.
He smiled suddenly. I agree with you. We must do away with some of these limits. I am going to tell you certain facts that will make certain things fairly clear to you. You, in turn, may be able to tell me certain facts.
I rather doubt it, said Miss Marple. One or two rather peculiar indications, perhaps, but indications are not facts.
Therefore, said Professor Wanstead, and paused.
For goodness sake, tell me something, said Miss Marple.
Chapter 12. A Consultation.
I'm not going to make a long story of things. I'll explain quite simply how I came into this matter. I act as confidential advisor from time to time for the Home Office. I'm also in touch with certain institutions. There are certain establishments which, in the event of crime, provide board and lodging for certain types of criminal who have been found guilty of certain acts. They remain there at what is termed Her Majesty's pleasure, sometimes for a definite length of time, and in direct association with their age. If they are below a certain age, they have to be received in some place of detention specially indicated. You understand that, no doubt.
Yes, I understand quite well what you mean.
Usually I'm consulted fairly soon after whatever the, shall we call it, crime has happened, to judge such matters as treatment, possibilities in the case, prognosis favourable or unfavourable, all the various words. They do not mean much, and I will not go into them. But occasionally, also, I am consulted by a responsible head of such an institution for a particular reason. In this matter, I received a communication from a certain department which was passed to me through the Home Office. I went to visit the head of this institution. In fact, the governor responsible for the prisoners or patients or whatever you like to call them. He was by way of being a friend of mine, a friend of fairly long standing, though not one with whom I was on terms of great intimacy. I went down to the institution in question, and the governor laid his troubles before me. They referred to one particular inmate. He was not satisfied about this inmate. He had certain doubts. This was the case of a young man, or one who had been a young man, in fact little more than a boy, when he came there. This was now several years ago. As time went on, and after the present governor had taken up his own residence there, he had not been there at the original arrival of this prisoner, he became worried. Not because he himself was a professional man, but because he was a man of experience of criminal patients and prisoners. To put it quite simply, this had been a boy who from his early youth had been completely unsatisfactory. You can call it by what term you like, a young delinquent, a young thug, a bad lot, a person of diminished responsibility. There are many terms. Some of them fit, some of them don't fit, some of them are merely puzzling. He was a criminal type, that was certain. He had joined gangs, he had beaten up people, he was a thief, he had stolen, he had embezzled, he had taken part in swindles, he had initiated certain frauds. In fact, he was a son who would be any father's despair.
Oh, I see, said Miss Marple.
And what do you see, Miss Marple?
Well, what I think I see is that you are talking of Mr. Raphael's son.
You are quite right. I am talking of Mr. Raphael's son. What do you know about him?
Nothing, said Miss Marple. I only heard, and that was yesterday, that Mr. Raphael had a delinquent or unsatisfactory, if we like to put it mildly, son. A son with a criminal record. I know very little about him. Was he Mr. Raphael's only son?
Yes, he was Mr. Raphael's only son. But Mr. Raphael also had two daughters. One of them died when she was 14. The elder daughter married quite happily but had no children.
Very sad for him.
Possibly, said Professor Wanstead. One never knows. His wife died young, and I think it possible that her death saddened him very much, though he was never willing to show it. How much he cared for his son and his daughters, I don't know. He provided for them. He did his best for them. He did his best for his son. But what his feelings were, one cannot say. He was not an easy man to read that way. I think his whole life and interest lay in his profession of making money. It was the making of it, like all great financiers, that interested him, not the actual money which he secured by it. That, as you might say, was sent out like a good servant to earn more money in more interesting and unexpected ways. He enjoyed finance. He loved finance. He thought of very little else. I think he did all that was possible for his son. He got him out of scrapes at school. He employed good lawyers to get him released from court proceedings whenever possible. But the final blow came, perhaps presaged by some early happenings. The boy was taken to court on a charge of assault against a young girl. It was said to be assault and rape, and he suffered a term of imprisonment for it, with some leniency shown because of his youth. But later, a second and really serious charge was brought against him.
"He killed a girl," said Miss Marple. "Is that right? That's what I heard."
"He lured a girl away from her home. It was some time before her body was found. She had been strangled, and afterwards her face and head had been disfigured by some heavy stones or rocks, presumably to prevent her identity being made known."
"Not a very nice business," said Miss Marple, in her most old ladylike tone. Professor Wanstead looked at her for a moment or two.
"You describe it that way?"
"It is how it seems to me," said Miss Marple. "I don't like that sort of thing. I never have. If you expect me to feel sympathy, regret, urge an unhappy childhood, blame bad environment, if you expect me, in fact, to weep over him, this young murderer of yours, I do not feel inclined so to do. I do not like evil beings who do evil things."
"I am delighted to hear it," said Professor Wanstead. "What I suffer in the course of my profession from people weeping and gnashing their teeth and blaming everything on some happening in the past, you would hardly believe. If people knew the bad environments that people have had, the unkindness, the difficulties of their lives, and the fact that nevertheless they can come through unscathed, I don't think they would so often take the opposite point of view. The misfits are to be pitied, yes. They are to be pitied, if I may say so, for the genes with which they are born and over which they have no control themselves. I pity epileptics in the same way. If you know what genes are..."
"I know more or less," said Miss Marple. "It's common knowledge nowadays, though naturally I have no exact chemical or technical knowledge.
The governor, a man of experience, told me exactly why he was so anxious to have my verdict. He had felt increasingly in his experience of this particular inmate that, in plain words, the boy was not a killer. He didn't think he was the type of a killer. He was like no killer he had ever seen before. He was of the opinion that the boy was the kind of criminal type who would never go straight, no matter what treatment was given to him, would never reform himself, and for whom nothing, in one sense of the word, could be done. But at the same time, he felt increasingly certain that the verdict upon him had been a wrong one. He did not believe that the boy had killed a girl, first strangled her and then disfigured her after rolling her body into a ditch. He just couldn't bring himself to believe it. He looked over the facts of the case, which seemed to be fully proved. This boy had known the girl. He had been seen with her on several different occasions before the crime. They had presumably slept together, and there were other points. His car had been seen in the neighbourhood. He himself had been recognised and all the rest of it. A perfectly fair case. But my friend was unhappy about it, he said. He was a man who had a very strong feeling for justice. He wanted a different opinion. He wanted, in fact, not the police side, which he knew. He wanted a professional medical view. That was my field, he said. My line of country entirely. He wanted me to see this young man and talk with him, visit him, make a professional appraisal of him, and give him my opinion.
Very interesting, said Miss Marple. Yes, I call that very interesting. After all, your friend, your governor, was a man of experience, a man who loved justice. He was a man whom you'd be willing to listen to.
Presumably, then, you did listen to him?
Yes, said Professor Wanstead. I was deeply interested. I saw the subject, as I will call him. I approached him from several different attitudes. I talked to him. I discussed various changes likely to occur in the law. I told him it might be possible to bring down a lawyer, a Queen's Counsel, to see what points there might be in his favour, and other things. I approached him as a friend, but also as an enemy, so that I could see how he responded to different approaches, and I also made a good many physical tests, such as we use very frequently nowadays. I will not go into those with you because they are wholly technical.
Then what did you think in the end?
I thought, said Professor Wanstead, I thought my friend was likely to be right. I did not think that Michael Raphael was a murderer.
What about the earlier case you mentioned?
That told against him, of course. Not in the jury's mind, because, of course, they did not hear about that until after the judge's summing up, but certainly in the judge's mind. It told against him, but I made a few inquiries myself afterwards. He had assaulted a girl. He had conceivably raped her, but he had not attempted to strangle her. And, in my opinion, I have seen a great many cases which come before the assizes, it seemed to me highly unlikely that there was a very definite case of rape. Girls, you must remember, are far more ready to be raped nowadays than they used to be. Their mothers insist very often that they should call it rape. The girl in question had had several boyfriends who had gone further than friendship. I did not think it counted very greatly as evidence against him. The actual murder case, yes, that was undoubtedly murder, but I continue to feel by all tests, physical tests, mental tests, psychological tests, none of them accorded with this particular crime.
Then what did you do?
I communicated with Mr. Raphael. I told him that I would like an interview with him on a certain matter concerning his son. I went to him. I told him what I thought, what the governor thought, that we had no evidence, that there were no grounds of appeal at present, but that we both believed that a miscarriage of justice had been committed. I said I thought possibly an inquiry might be held. It might be an expensive business. It might bring out certain facts that could be laid before the Home Office. It might be successful. It might not. There might be something there, some evidence, if you looked for it. I said it would be expensive to look for it, but I presumed that would make no difference to anyone in his position. I had realized by that time that he was a sick man, a very ill man. He told me so himself. He told me that he had been in expectation of an early death, that he'd been warned 2 years ago that death could not be delayed for what they first thought was about a year. But later they realized that he would last rather longer because of his unusual physical strength. I asked him what he felt about his son.
And what did he feel about his son? Said Miss Marple.
Ah, you want to know that. So did I. He was, I think, extremely honest with me, even if
rather ruthless? Said Miss Marple.
Yes, Miss Marple, you are using the right word. He was a ruthless man. But he was a just man and an honest man. He said, I've known what my son was like for many years. I've not tried to change him because I don't believe that anyone could change him. He is made a certain way. He is crooked. He's a bad lot. He'll always be in trouble. He's dishonest. Nobody, nothing could make him go straight. I'm well assured of that. I have, in a sense, washed my hands of him. Though not legally or outwardly, he has always had money if he required it. Help, legal or otherwise, if he gets into trouble. I have done always what I could do. Well, let us say if I had a son who was a spastic, who was sick, who was epileptic, I would do what I could for him. If you have a son who is sick morally, shall we say, and for whom there is no cure, I have done what I could also. No more and no less. What can I do for him now? I told him that it depended what he wanted to do. There's no difficulty about that, he said. I am handicapped, but I can see quite clearly what I want to do. I want to get him vindicated. I want to get him released from confinement.
I want to get him free to continue to lead his own life as best he can lead it. If he must lead it in further dishonesties, then he must lead it that way. I will leave provision for him to do everything that can be done. I don't want him suffering, imprisoned, cut off from his life because of a perfectly natural and unfortunate mistake. If somebody else, some other man, killed that girl, I want the fact brought to light and recognized. I want justice for Michael. But I am handicapped. I'm a very ill man. My time is measured now not in years or months, but in weeks.
Lawyers, I suggested.
I know a firm. He cut me short. Your lawyers will be useless. You can employ them, but they will be useless. I must arrange what I can arrange in such a limited time.
He offered me a large fee to undertake the search for the truth, and to undertake everything possible, with no expense spared.
I can do next to nothing myself. Death may come at any moment. I empower you as my chief help. And to assist you, at my request, I will try to find a certain person. He wrote down a name for me. Miss Jane Marple. He said, I don't want to give you her address. I want you to meet her in surroundings of my own choosing. And he then told me of this tour. This charming, harmless, innocent tour of historic houses, castles, and gardens. He would provide me with a reservation on it ahead for a certain date. Miss Jane Marple, he said, will also be on that tour. You will meet her there, you will encounter her casually, and thus it will be seen clearly to be a casual meeting.
I was to choose my own time and moment to make myself known to you if I thought that that would be the better way.
You have already asked me if I or my friend the governor had any reason to suspect or know of any other person who might have been guilty of the murder. My friend the governor certainly suggested nothing of the kind, and he had already taken up the matter with the police officer who had been in charge of the case, a most reliable detective superintendent with very good experience in these matters.
No other man was suggested? No other friend of the girl's? No other former friend who might have been supplanted?
There was nothing of that kind to find. I asked him to tell me a little about you. He did not, however, consent to do so. He told me you were elderly. He told me that you were a person who knew about people. He told me one other thing. He paused.
What's the other thing? Said Miss Marple. I have some natural curiosity, you know. I really can't think of any other advantage I conceivably could have. I'm slightly deaf. My eyesight is not quite as good as it used to be. I cannot really think that I have any advantages beyond the fact that I may, I suppose, seem rather foolish and simple, and am, in fact, what used to be called in rather earlier days, an old pussy. I am an old pussy. Is that the sort of thing he said?
No, said Professor Wanstead. What he said was he thought you had a very fine sense of evil.
Oh, said Miss Marple. She was taken aback. Professor Wanstead was watching her.
Would you say that was true? He said.
Miss Marple was quiet for quite a long time. At last she said, Perhaps it is. Yes, perhaps. I have at several different times in my life been apprehensive, have recognized that there was evil in the neighborhood, the surroundings, that the environment of someone who was evil was near me, connected with what was happening. She looked at him suddenly and smiled. It's rather, you know, she said, like being born with a very keen sense of smell. You can smell a leak of gas when other people can't do so. You can distinguish one perfume from another very easily. I had an aunt once, continued Miss Marple thoughtfully, who said she could smell when people told a lie. She said there was quite a distinctive odour came to her. Their noses twitched, she said, and then the smell came. I don't know if it was true or not, but, well, on several occasions she was quite remarkable. She said to my uncle once, Don't, Jack, engage that young man you were talking to this morning. He was telling you lies the whole time he was talking. That turned out to be quite true.
A sense of evil, said Professor Wanstead. Well, if you do sense evil, tell me. I shall be glad to know. I don't think I have a particular sense of evil myself. Ill health, yes, but not evil up here.
He tapped his forehead.
I'd better tell you briefly how I came into things now, said Miss Marple. Mr. Raphael, as you know, died. His lawyers asked me to come and see them, apprised me of his proposition. I received a letter from him which explained nothing. After that, I heard nothing more for some little time. Then I got a letter from the company who run these tours, saying that Mr. Raphael, before his death, had made a reservation for me, knowing that I should enjoy a trip very much, and wanting to give it me as a surprise present. I was very astonished, but took it as an indication of the first step that I was to undertake. I was to go on this tour, and presumably in the course of the tour, some other indication or hint or clue or direction would come to me. I think it did. The day before, I was received on my arrival here by three ladies who live at an old manor house here, and who very kindly extended an invitation to me. They had heard from Mr. Raphael, they said, who had written some time before his death, saying that a very old friend of his would be coming on this tour, and would they be kind enough to put her up for 2 or 3 days, as he thought she was not fit to attempt the particular ascent of this rather difficult climb up the headland, to where there was a memorial tower, which was the principal event of yesterday's tour.
And you took that also as an indication of what you were to do?
Of course, said Miss Marple. There can be no other reason for it. He was not a man to shower benefits for nothing, out of compassion for an old lady who wasn't good at walking up hills. No, he wanted me to go there.
And you went there, and what then?
Nothing, said Miss Marple. Three sisters.
Three weird sisters?
They ought to have been, said Miss Marple, but I don't think they were. They didn't seem to be, anyway. I don't know yet. I suppose they may have been. They may be, I mean. They seem ordinary enough. They didn't belong to this house. It had belonged to an uncle of theirs, and they'd come here to live some years ago. They are in rather poor circumstances. They are amiable, not particularly interesting, all slightly different in type. They do not appear to have been well acquainted with Mr. Raphael. Any conversation I have had with them appears to yield nothing.
So you learnt nothing during your stay?
I learnt the facts of the case you've just told me. Not from them, from an elderly servant who started her reminiscences dating back to the time of the uncle. She knew of Mr. Raphael only as a name, but she was eloquent on the theme of the murder. It had all started with a visit here of a son of Mr. Raphael's who was a bad lot. Of how the girl had fallen in love with him, and that he'd strangled the girl, and how sad and tragic and terrible it all was. With bells on, as you might say, said Miss Marple, using a phrase of her youth. Plenty of exaggeration, but it was a nasty story, and she seemed to believe that the police view was that this hadn't been his only murder.
It didn't seem to you to connect up with the three weird sisters?
No, only that they'd been the guardians of the girl and had loved her dearly. No more than that.
They might know something. Something about another man.
Yes, that's what we want, isn't it? The other man. A man of brutality who wouldn't hesitate to bash in a girl's head after he'd killed her. The kind of man who could be driven frantic with jealousy. There are men like that.
No other curious things happened at the old manor?
Not really. One of the sisters, the youngest, I think, kept talking about the garden. She sounded as though she was a very keen gardener, but she couldn't be, because she didn't know the names of half the things. I laid a trap or two for her, mentioning special rare shrubs and saying, did she know it? And yes, she said, wasn't it a wonderful plant? I said it was not very hardy, and she agreed. But she didn't know anything about plants. That reminds me.
Reminds you of what?
Well, you'll think I'm just silly about gardens and plants, but I mean one does know things about them. I mean I know a few things about birds, and I know some things about gardens.
And I gather that it's not birds but gardens that are troubling you.
Yes. Have you noticed two middle-aged women on this tour, Miss Barrow and Miss Cook?
Yes, I've noticed them. Pair of middle-aged spinsters travelling together.
That's right. Well, I found out something odd about Miss Cook. That is her name, isn't it? I mean, it's her name on the tour.
Why? Has she got another name?
I think so. She's the same person who visited me. Well, I won't say visited me exactly, but she was outside my garden fence in St. Mary Mead, the village where I live. She expressed pleasure at my garden and talked about gardening with me. Told me she was living in the village and working in somebody's garden who'd moved into a new house there. I rather think, said Miss Marple, yes, I rather think that the whole thing was lies. There again, she knew nothing about gardening. She pretended to, but it wasn't true.
Why do you think she came there?
I'd no idea at the time. She said her name was Bartlett, and the name of the woman she said she was living with began with H, though I can't remember it for the moment. Her hair was not only differently done, but it was a different colour, and her clothes were of a different style. I didn't recognise her at first on this trip, just wondered why her face was vaguely familiar, and then suddenly it came to me, because of the dyed hair. I said where I had seen her before. She admitted that she'd been there, but pretended that she, too, hadn't recognised me. All lies.
And what's your opinion about all that?
Well, one thing, certainly. Miss Cook, to give her her present name, came to St. Mary Mead just to have a look at me, so that she'd be quite sure to be able to recognise me when we met again.
And why was that felt to be necessary?
I don't know. There are two possibilities. I'm not sure that I like one of them very much.
I don't know, said Professor Wanstead, that I like it very much either.
They were both silent for a minute or two, and then Professor Wanstead said,
I don't like what happened to Elizabeth Temple. You've talked to her during this trip?
Yes, I have. When she's better, I'd like to talk to her again. She could tell me, us, things about the girl who was murdered. She spoke to me of this girl who had been at her school, who had been going to marry Mr. Raphael's son, but didn't marry him. Instead, she died. I asked how or why she died, and she answered with the word love. I took it as meaning a suicide, but it was murder. Murder through jealousy would fit.
Another man.
Some other man we've got to find. Miss Temple may be able to tell us who he was.
No other sinister possibilities?
I think really it is casual information we need. I see no reason to believe that there is any sinister suggestion in any of the coach passengers, or any sinister suggestion about the people living in the old manor house. But one of those three sisters may have known or remembered something that the girl or Michael once said. Clotilde used to take the girl abroad. Therefore she may know of something that occurred on some foreign trip, perhaps. Something that the girl said or mentioned or did on some trip. Some man that the girl met. Something which has nothing to do with the old manor house here. It is difficult, because only by talking, by casual information, can you get any clue. The second sister, Mrs. Glynn, married fairly early, has spent time, I gather, in India and in Africa. She may have heard of something through her husband, or through her husband's relations, through various things that are unconnected with the old manor house here, although she has visited it from time to time. She knew the murdered girl, presumably, but I should think she knew her much less well than the other two. But that does not mean that she may not know some significant facts about the girl. The third sister is more scatty, more localised, does not seem to have known the girl as well. But still, she too may have information about possible lovers or boyfriends, seen the girl with an unknown man. That's her, by the way, passing the hotel now.
Miss Marple, however occupied by her tête-à-tête, had not relinquished the habits of a lifetime. A public thoroughfare was always, to her, an observation post. all the passers-by, either loitering or hurrying, had been noticed automatically.
"Anthea Bradbury Scott, the one with the big parcel. She's going to the post office, I suppose. It's just round the corner, isn't it?"
"Looks a bit daft to me," said Professor Wanstead. "All that floating hair, grey hair too, a kind of Ophelia of 50.
"I thought of Ophelia too when I first saw her. Oh dear, I wish I knew what I ought to do next. Stay here at the Golden Boar for a day or two, or go on with the coach tour. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. If you stick your fingers in it long enough, you ought to come up with something, even if one does get pricked in the process."
Chapter 13. Black and Red Check. Mrs. Sanborn returned just as the party was sitting down to lunch. Her news was not good. Miss Temple was still unconscious. She certainly could not be moved for several days. Having given the bulletin, Mrs. Sanborn turned the conversation to practical matters. She produced suitable timetables of trains for those who wished to return to London and proposed suitable plans for the resumption of the tour on the morrow or the next day. She had a list of suitable short expeditions in the near neighbourhood for this afternoon, small groups in hired cars. Professor Wanstead drew Miss Marple aside as they went out of the dining room.
"You may want to rest this afternoon. If not, I will call for you here in an hour's time. There is an interesting church you might care to see."
"That would be very nice," said Miss Marple.
Miss Marple sat quite still in the car that had come to fetch her. Professor Wanstead had called for her at the time he had said.
"I thought you might enjoy seeing this particular church, and a very pretty village, too," he explained. "There's no reason, really, why one should not enjoy the local sights when one can."
"It's very kind of you, I'm sure," Miss Marple had said.
She had looked at him with that slightly fluttery gaze of hers.
"Very kind," she said. "It just seems, well, I don't want to say it seems heartless, but, well, you know what I mean."
"My dear lady, Miss Temple is not an old friend of yours or anything like that, sad as this accident has been."
"Well," said Miss Marple again, "this is very kind of you."
Professor Wanstead had opened the door of the car and Miss Marple got into it. It was, she presumed, a hired car. A kindly thought, to take an elderly lady to see one of the sights of the neighbourhood. He might have taken somebody younger, more interesting, and certainly better looking. Miss Marple looked at him thoughtfully once or twice as they drove through the village. He was not looking at her. He was gazing out of his own window. When they had left the village behind and were on a second-class country road twisting round the hillside, he turned his head and said to her,
"We are not going to a church, I'm afraid."
"No," said Miss Marple. "I thought perhaps we weren't."
"Yes, the idea would have come to you."
"Where are we going, may I ask?"
"We are going to a hospital in Carristown."
"Ah, yes, that was where Miss Temple was taken?" It was a question, though it hardly needed to be one.
"Yes," he said. "Mrs. Sanborn saw her and brought me back a letter from the hospital authorities. I have just finished talking to them on the telephone."
"Is she going on well?"
"No, not going on very well."
"I see. At least, I hope I don't see," said Miss Marple.
"Her recovery is very problematical, but there is nothing that can be done. She may not recover consciousness again. On the other hand, she may have a few lucid intervals."
"And you are taking me there? Why? I am not a friend of hers, you know. I only just met her for the first time on this trip."
"Yes, I realize that. I'm taking you there because in one of the lucid intervals she has had, she asked for you."
"I see," said Miss Marple. "I wonder why she should ask for me. Why she should have thought that I could be useful in any way to her or do anything. She is a woman of perception. In her way, you know, a great woman. As headmistress of Fallowfield, she occupied a prominent position in the educational world.
The best girls' school there is, I suppose.
Yes. She was a great personality. She was herself a woman of considerable scholarship. Mathematics were her speciality, but she was an all-round, what I should call an educator. Was interested in education, what girls were fitted for, how to encourage them. Oh, many other things. It is sad and very cruel if she dies, said Miss Marple. It will seem such a waste of a life. Although she had retired from her headmistresship, she still exercised a lot of power. This accident... She stopped. Perhaps you do not want us to discuss the accident.
I think it is better that we should do so. A big boulder crashed down the hillside. It has been known to happen before, though only at very long-divided intervals of time. However, somebody came and spoke to me about it, said Professor Wanstead.
Came and spoke to you about the accident? Who was it?
The two young people, Joanna Crawford and Emlyn Price.
What did they say?
Joanna told me that she had the impression there was someone on the hillside, rather high up. She and Emlyn were climbing up from the lower main path, following a rough track that wound round the curve of the hill. As they turned a corner, she definitely saw, outlined against the skyline, a man or a woman who was trying to roll a big boulder forward along the ground. The boulder was rocking, and finally it started to roll, at first slowly and then gathering speed down the hillside. Miss Temple was walking along the main path below and had come to a point just underneath it when the boulder hit her. If it was done deliberately, it might not, of course, have succeeded. It might have missed her, but it did succeed. If what was being attempted was a deliberate attack on the woman walking below, it succeeded only too well.
Was it a man or a woman they saw?
Asked Miss Marple. Unfortunately, Joanna Crawford could not say. Whoever it was wearing jeans or trousers and had on a lurid polo-neck pullover in red and black checks. The figure turned and moved out of sight almost immediately. She's inclined to think it was a man, but cannot be certain.
And she thinks, or you think, that it was a deliberate attempt on Miss Temple's life?
The more she mulls it over, the more she thinks that that was exactly what it was. The boy agrees.
You have no idea who it might have been?
No idea whatever. No more have they. It might be one of our fellow travellers, someone who went for a stroll that afternoon. It might be someone completely unknown, who knew that the coach was making a halt here and chose this place to make an attack on one of the passengers. Some youthful lover of violence for violence's sake. Or it might have been an enemy.
It seems very melodramatic if one says, a secret enemy, said Miss Marple.
Yes, it does. Who would want to kill a retired and respected headmistress? That is a question we want answered. It is possible, faintly possible, that Miss Temple herself might be able to tell us. She might have recognised the figure above her, or she might, more likely, have known of someone who bore her ill will for some special reason.
It still seems unlikely.
I agree with you, said Professor Wanstead. She seems a totally unlikely person to be a fit victim of attack. But yet, when one reflects, a headmistress knows a great many people. A great many people, or shall we put it this way, have passed through her hands.
A lot of girls, you mean, have passed through her hands?
Yes, yes, that is what I meant. Girls and their families. A headmistress must have knowledge of many things. Romances, for instance, that girls might indulge in, unknown to their parents. It happens, you know. It happens very often, especially in the last 10 or 20 years. Girls are said to mature earlier. That is physically true, though in a deeper sense of the word, they mature late. They remain childish longer. Childish in the clothes they like to wear. Childish with their floating hair. Even their miniskirts represent a worship of childishness. Their baby doll nightdresses, their gym slips and shorts, all children's fashions. They wish not to become adult, not to have to accept our kind of responsibility. And yet, like all children, they want to be thought grown up and free to do what they think are grown-up things. And that leads sometimes to tragedy, and sometimes to the aftermath of tragedy.
Are you thinking of some particular case?
No, no, not really. I'm only thinking, well, shall we say, letting possibilities pass through my mind. I cannot believe that Elizabeth Temple had a personal enemy, an enemy ruthless enough to wish to take an opportunity of killing her. What I do think...
He looked at Miss Marple.
Would you like to make a suggestion?
Of a possibility? Well, I think I know or guess what you are suggesting. You are suggesting that Miss Temple knew something, knew some fact or had some knowledge that would be inconvenient or even dangerous to somebody if it was known.
Yes, I do feel exactly that.
In that case, said Miss Marple, it seems indicated that there is someone on our coach tour who recognized Miss Temple or knew who she was, but who, perhaps after the passage of some years, was not remembered or might even not have been recognized by Miss Temple. It seems to throw it back on our passengers, does it not? She paused. That pullover you mentioned, red and black checks, you said?
Oh, yes, the pullover.
He looked at her curiously.
What was it that struck you about that?
It was very noticeable, said Miss Marple. That is what your words led me to infer. It was very mentionable, so much so that the girl Joanna mentioned it specifically.
Yes, and what does that suggest to you?
The trailing of flags, said Miss Marple thoughtfully. Something that will be seen, remembered, observed, recognized.
Yes,
Professor Wanstead looked at her with encouragement. When you describe a person you have seen not close at hand but from a distance, the first thing you will describe will be their clothes. Not their faces, not their walk, not their hands, not their feet. A scarlet tam-o'-shanter, a purple cloak, a bizarre leather jacket, a pullover of brilliant reds and blacks. Something very recognizable, very noticeable. The object of it being that when that person removes that garment, gets rid of it, sends it by post in a parcel to some address, say about 100 miles away, or thrusts it in a rubbish bin in a city, or burns it, or tears it up, or destroys it, she or he will be the one person modestly and rather drably attired who will not be suspected or looked at or thought of. It must have been meant, that scarlet and black check jersey, meant so that it will be recognized again, though actually it will never again be seen on that particular person.
A very sound idea, said Professor Wanstead. As I have told you, continued the professor, Fallowfield is situated not very far from here, 16 miles, I think. So this is Elizabeth Temple's part of the world, a part she knows well, with people in it that she also might know well.
Yes, it widens the possibilities, said Miss Marple. I agree with you, she said presently, that the attacker is more likely to have been a man than a woman. That boulder, if it was done with intent, was sent on its course very accurately. Accuracy is more a male quality than a female one. On the other hand, there might easily have been someone on our coach, or possibly in the neighbourhood, who saw Miss Temple in the street. A former pupil of hers in past years, someone whom she herself might not recognise after a period of time. But the girl or woman would have recognised her, because a headmaster or headmistress of over 60 is not unlike the same headmaster or headmistress at the age of 50. She is recognisable.
Some woman who recognised her former mistress and also knew that her mistress knew something damaging about her. Someone who might in some way prove a danger to her.
She sighed.
I myself do not know this part of the world at all. Have you any particular knowledge of it?
No, said Professor Wanstead. I could not claim a personal knowledge of this part of the country. I know something, however, of various things that have happened in this part of the world, entirely because of what you have told me. If it had not been for my acquaintanceship with you and the things you've told me, I could have been more at sea than I am. What are you yourself actually doing here? You do not know. Yet you were sent here. It was deliberately arranged by Raphael that you should come here, that you should take this coach tour, that you and I should meet. There have been other places where we have stopped or through which we have passed, but special arrangements were made so that you should actually stay for a couple of nights here. You were put up with former friends of his who would not have refused any request he made. Was there a reason for that?
So that I could learn certain facts that I had to know, said Miss Marple.
A series of murders that took place a good many years ago.
Professor Wanstead looked doubtful.
There is nothing unusual in that. You can say the same of many places in England and Wales. These things seem always to go in a series. First, a girl found assaulted and murdered. Then another girl, not very far away. Then something of the same kind, perhaps 20 miles away. The same pattern of death.
Two girls were reported missing from Jocelyn St. Mary itself. The one that we have been discussing, whose body was found 6 months later, many miles away, and who was last seen in the company of Michael Raphael.
And the other?
A girl called Nora Broad. Not a quiet girl with no boyfriends. Possibly with one boyfriend too many. Her body was never found.
It will be one day. There have been cases when 20 years have passed, said Wanstead.
He slowed down.
We have arrived. This is Carristown, and here is the hospital.
Shepherded by Professor Wanstead, Miss Marple entered. The professor was obviously expected. He was ushered into a small room where a woman rose from a desk.
Oh, yes, she said. Professor Wanstead. And this is...
She hesitated slightly.
Miss Jane Marple, said Professor Wanstead. I talked to Sister Barker on the telephone.
Oh, yes. Sister Barker said that she would be accompanying you.
How is Miss Temple?
Much the same, I think. I'm afraid there is not much improvement to report.
She rose.
I will take you to Sister Barker.
Sister Barker was a tall, thin woman. She had a low, decisive voice and dark grey eyes that had a habit of looking at you and looking away almost immediately, leaving you with the feeling that you had been inspected in a very short space of time and judgment pronounced upon you.
"I don't know what arrangements you have in mind," said Professor Wanstead. "Well, I had better tell Miss Marple just what we have arranged.
First, I must make it clear to you that the patient, Miss Temple, is still in a coma, with very rare intervals. She appears to come to occasionally, to recognize her surroundings and to be able to say a few words. But there is nothing one can do to stimulate her. It has to be left to the utmost patience."
I expect Professor Wanstead has already told you that in one of her intervals of consciousness she uttered quite distinctly the words, Miss Jane Marple, and then, I want to speak to her, Miss Jane Marple. After that, she relapsed into unconsciousness.
Doctor thought it advisable to get in touch with the other occupants of the coach.
Professor Wanstead came to see us and explain various matters and said he would bring you over. I'm afraid that all we can ask you to do is to sit in the private ward where Miss Temple is and perhaps be ready to make a note of any words she should say if she does regain consciousness. I am afraid the prognosis is not very helpful.
To be quite frank, which is better, I think, since you are not a near relative and are unlikely to be disturbed by this information, Doctor thinks that she is sinking fast, that she may die without recovering consciousness. There is nothing one can do to relieve the concussion. It is important that someone should hear what she says. And Doctor thinks it advisable that she should not see too many people round her if she regains consciousness. If Miss Marple is not worried at the thought of sitting there alone, there will be a nurse in the room, though not obviously so. That is, she will not be noticed from the bed and will not move unless she's asked for. She will sit in a corner of the room shielded by a screen. She added, we have a police official there also ready to take down anything. The doctor thinks it advisable that he also should not be noticed by Miss Temple. One person alone, and that possibly a person she expects to see, will not alarm her or make her lose knowledge of what she wants to say to you. I hope this will not be too difficult a thing to ask you.
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. I am quite prepared to do that. I have a small notebook with me and a biro pen that will not be in evidence. I can remember things by heart for a very short time, so I need not appear to be obviously taking notes of what she says. You can trust my memory, and I am not deaf in the real sense of the word. I don't think my hearing is quite as good as it used to be, but if I am sitting near a bedside, I ought to be able to hear anything she says quite easily, even if it is whispered. I am used to sick people. I have had a good deal to do with them in my time.
Again the lightning glance of Sister Barker went over Miss Marple. This time a faint inclination of the head showed satisfaction.
"It is kind of you," she said, "and I am sure that if there is any help you can give, we can rely on you to give it. If Professor Wanstead likes to sit in the waiting room downstairs, we can call him at any moment if it should be necessary. Now, Miss Marple, perhaps you will accompany me."